Hi, I'm Eric. I'm at La Pasadita, and you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above-ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Eric. Delicious tacos. Love it. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above-ground audio magazine. This is show number 686, and what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And we'd love for you to say hello online. You could go on Twitter at Outside the Loop is the Twitter handle. You can go on to Facebook as well. Also, download the podcast of the show. If you don't do that already, it's free. It gets delivered to your device each week. We would love for you to do that. Check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com for the audio archives of this show. And we say hello to the producer of the program. His name is Colin Seaman. Hello, Colin Seaman.
Hello, Michael Steven.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I'll tell you some big news here as it pertains to tacos, actually, this week. Colin, I don't know if you've heard about this, but are you a fan of the Big Star tacos?
So I have never actually sat down for a Big Star taco.
Okay.
I've had it like delivered, but I do not feel that is the way to experience a Big Star taco.
Correct.
So no.
Okay, so Big Star, if you don't know what Big Star is, it is this taco, sort of like a honky-tonk taco joint in Wicker Park at Damon North of Milwaukee, basically. And it's, I'll say this, it has become sort of a scene. It's kind of scene-y. Like, people go there to be seen. At least, that's kind of the vibe I got, because there are long lines outside of that place. And I think part of it, they have a nice patio, and so people like to go there and just kind of be seen at the bar patio. Well, anyway, Big Star, and I know, Colin, that you've had some Half Acre before.
That is correct.
They're going to combine and join forces here. Big Star is going to open a new restaurant inside Half Acre Brewing.
On Lincoln?
The one, I think it's on Berteaux.
Do they have a different one?
It will be. Yeah, I think it's the big one. It's at 2050 West Balmoral.
Interesting.
Yeah, Balmoral. That's not Berteaux. Balmoral on the north side. So that's the brewery. So Big Star is going to unite with Half Acre. That was the big taco news this week.
So we're expecting what? Beer battered fish tacos, beer infused.
I'm sure
the pairings.
I think the pairings, because that's really what, I mean, it's about. Beer you can cook with, we know that. But I think it's going to be about the pairings.
Grab some hoppy tacos?
Some taco hop.
Taco hop.
We're just giving them marketing ideas here, you know? This is for free. Although I'll say this, Big Star Tacos, if I have to be a critic, and you know I take my tacos seriously, if I have to be a critic about it, I would say they should give us more. Right. And I know there's the argument, well, you know, you have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But for example, La Pasadita gives you a nice portion of the taco and it's very satisfying. When I had the Big Star tacos and I had them there, you know, cool time, a lot of fun. But I just wanted more in terms of the portion. I guess that's the strategy, right? Because then you have to get more tacos to get satiated.
I think we need to do some investigation.
You mean like a on location field investigation?
Possible. I know a guy who likes tacos and has a radio show. Speaking of radio show, what are we doing today?
Well, Colin, that is a good question. We are thinking about tacos as always. Today, we will check in with our good pal, Steve Krakow, who writes the Secret History of Chicago music strip in the Chicago Reader. He also hand draws this strip. It's a work of art. In every edition here with the Secret History of Chicago Music. He's profiling a band called Ear Dance. We'll find out what that band is all about. Also, this week was the 50th anniversary of the killing of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, leaders of the local Black Panther Party back in 1969. We'll talk with a Tribune reporter about the significance of that event, and we will discuss transportation. We have a great transportation network here in our region, but what about for those who are seniors and have disabilities. We will talk about transportation accessibility for everyone. So stay tuned. Lots to do on the show this morning. Really happy that you are with us. Dreaming about tacos, it's a good thing.
My greatest enemy, not what I wanna see. It's what stares back at me. Put all your trust in me.
And the local music that we are featuring this week comes from the project called Violet Mice. Violet Mice. It's actually an artist by the name of Annie Fish. And she recently, fairly recently, moved from Chicago to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I guess it still kind of qualifies as local music. You can check out violetmice.com for more information on this artist. The new album that's out right now called Everything, or it's actually not out right now. It's coming out in January 7th of 2020. The album is called Everything Is Always Bad.
Maybe a commentary on living in New Mexico?
That very well could be, Colin.
New Mexico is a beautiful place. Not as pretty as Chicago,
some would say. Each week I love to feature local music here on this program. If you have any, you could go to OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and send us some of your tracks. And if you have any gigs coming up, we can mention those too. This week, we're hearing some tunes from Violet Mice. This week was the 50th anniversary of the killing of Black Panther leaders Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. On December 4th, 1969, Chicago police raided a two-flat at 2337 West Monroe in Chicago and shot and killed Hampton and Clark. The fallout from this event was significant, especially depending on the differing communities in the city. William Lee is a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and he wrote a piece that ran earlier this week about the 50th anniversary of this historic event. He is on the phone with us here on Outside the Loop this morning. Will, welcome. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You are quite welcome. So let's just start out here with some context about what was happening at the time here in 1969, the height of racial tensions. We're talking about the rise of the Black Panther Party for self-defense in response to white oppression and police brutality. And there was really this distrust between Black folks and law enforcement, wasn't there?
There was, and I would add to that that at that time, Chicago police really did have the, you know, the reputation as headcrackers. It really was something that, you know, that went across, you know, African Americans, of course, knew, but it was something just from my years of reporting that even in, you know, white communities, teenagers of that time and era remember. You didn't really step out of line with cops. And it was, you know, this was 69 was after the 68 convention where the police famously, ran through Lincoln Park. And it was also, after the 68 riots where the first Mayor Daley gave that infamous shoot to kill order that many Black people interpreted as a shoot to kill order on them. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are going on in the world right then. And then you have the spread across the country of the Black Panther Party of self-defense. And they fell here in Chicago in the hands of a young guy who everyone seemed was just magnetically attracted by the name of Fred Hampton.
Yeah, Fred Hampton, really this charismatic leader. And, you know, it comes out later as history has unfolded here that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover was really concerned about people like Fred Hampton. And in fact, with the program, the counterintelligence program, also known as COINTELPRO, he specifically says in this report, we have to prevent the rise of a Black Messiah, which you could say that Fred Hampton, for some, fit that bill.
Oh, absolutely. It was everyone who I've spoken with who actually knew him, knew the man, why he was living. He was he was one of those once in a lifetime type of figures, especially here in Chicago. You had a young guy who was not just well spoken, but he was a passionate speaker. That's what really drew people to him. Yeah. I mentioned in a story about in the NAACP that he was one time the youth chair, and under his leadership, it went from 7 to 700. That's exactly how influential a guy he was. So
yeah, and really, you know, I think when you talk about the Panthers too, the Black Panther Party, and by the way, you know, I said the Black Panther Party for self-defense. I think it's that for self-defense part of the title that often gets left out, and we have this sort of imagery of the militant, the sort of the guns and the leather coats and the berets and the sunglasses. But really, this was a party that looked at trying to defend the Black community from what they saw as white oppression, but also provide for the Black community with things like the free breakfast program.
Oh, absolutely. So you had also at that time, we talked about some of the tension between, you know, communities and the police, but you also had a situation where this was after many of the African-Americans who were in the city were starting to leave the neighborhoods. A lot of resources, a lot of things are starting to leave. You have folks who are left behind with no resources. A lot of the, you know, businesses and shops, that's when you start to see the first wave of closings, and those who are left behind are left in the very broken down neighborhoods without medical care. You know, how are they going to care for the children? How are they going to feed the children who are going to school all day? All these sorts of things. So the Panthers really reached out with their 10-point program and really tried to really strike the communities, you know, help them where they needed. And that is exactly what put them in the crosshairs of J. Edgar Hoover.
You know, the official story that came out from the Chicago police was that the Panthers shot at the police and there was this firefight. But of course, as history, like I said, unfolds, we know that that is not the case. And it's interesting, you mentioned that in this piece. You also mentioned that the Chicago Tribune, your paper, I mean, had a little bit of a role in that, publishing what they said initially was evidence of a firefight.
Oh, yeah, very famously. Of course, at that time, the Tribune was the paper of the establishment. And it was the state's attorney at that time, Ed Hanrahan, offered an exclusive to the paper where they walked him through and then supposedly pointed out all of the different things that we had. And I'm sure the people at that time thought that they had a rock-solid story from the powers to be. But almost immediately, the Panthers opened up the shot-out building for people who came and quickly debunked it, you know, pointing out all these different sorts of holes and say, oh, this hole looks like it came from outside. This one came from outside. Ultimately, they found out they found only one. The federal government only found one shot that looked like it came from inside. The rest, the remaining 82 to 99 shots came from outside. It was determined. Poked a hole in the whole idea that this was, you know, militants acting out against the police.
Right. You know, and again, depending on the group that you belong to at this time, you either, I think, saw this as a murder, right, of individuals, or you saw this as the police trying to preserve order by stopping violent Black nationalists. This really was, it was divisive what happened here. And it really, you know, we talk about this issue of race. I think and you point this out in your piece, I mean, the legacy of that, it's really intact here, isn't it?
Well, Chicago is just one of those cities where our racial sort of heritage has just always been a part of where you are. If you're a Chicagoan, a native Chicagoan, you know that. We sort of wore our racism, our racist sort of ideas on our sleeves. And in this particular case, you had this for Black Americans of that generation. They saw this as nothing more than an extrajudicial killing of someone who might have been a leader. And years later, after Hoover's death, you had the FBI taking the very much unprecedented step of apologizing for all of these actions. You know, this is the FBI. This is the original law and order organization. You know, J. Edgar came up with the idea of the G-Man, and here you are just 4 years after his death, you have the head apologizing for this organization that was only supposed to be acting in the best wishes of the citizens. And this is, you know, the exact opposite of that, they say.
That distrust, I mean, you could make an argument, and I think a very cogent argument, that it still exists today. And we've certainly seen data that show, when we talk about brutality and we talk about who is the recipient of that brutality, there's still an issue with race, certainly in this country, but also in the city of Chicago, with, you know, who is getting killed, who is getting surveilled. And really, the when we talk about tensions, I think that there is still is tension. I mean, we think about the Laquan McDonald issue that really is still in the conversation, and that's still a very real thing in Chicago.
Well, I worked earlier this year. I worked on something on the 1919 race riots, the 100-year anniversary of that, which was in many ways a sort of stone that really set all of this in motion. A lot of the sort of racial lines and boundaries and rules, both spoken and unspoken, were set up from that time. And here we are 100 years ago, and very much some of those same boundaries and, you know, rules are still in place. So I don't think you can really talk about, getting past these things unless you completely have a complete teardown of that system. And we're still, it's still a work in progress.
It's still a work in progress, and I think it's important for us to know that this happened, to understand the history, and to understand that the issues that we're talking about in 2019, to your point, in a way, we were talking about this in 1919, we were talking about this in 1969, so here we are in 2019, living in the future, we're still having these conversations.
Well, let's hope 2099, we're not talking about this topic anymore. That we moved past it and we found a better way to speak with each other and how to live together.
Absolutely. Well, check out what William Lee writes and what he has written. This piece on the 50th anniversary of the murder of Black Panther leaders Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. It's up at ChicagoTribune.com, so be sure to check that out. William Lee is a reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Hey, Will, thanks so much for talking to us today. This is something that we need to, again, keep talking about. We have to work through these issues and live together. And I really appreciate all the hard work.
It's my pleasure, Mike.
How can we make metropolitan Chicago a place where it is as easy for seniors and people with disabilities to get around as it is for everyone else? Well, the Metropolitan Planning Council addresses this question. It's been around since 1934, and it works to shape a more equitable, sustainable, and prosperous Chicago region. Jeremy Glover is a transportation associate at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Be sure to check him out online, metroplanning.org. He is on the line with us here on Outside the Loop today. Jeremy, welcome to the program. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So let's talk about this. Our region has the second largest transit network in the country, and that's great, and we're proud of that, but there's also an entire secondary network of transportation services that serve people with disabilities. And you say that this network is fragmented. Why is this the case?
That's right. There are over 50 providers at least. We actually don't really even know the number of different services that exist in our region, specifically to serve this population. They were created over the course of decades, largely to serve very specific needs in very specific communities. And they were rarely ever coordinated in any real way or, consolidated in any real way. And what we've ended up with are a patchwork of services where there might be different eligibility requirements. There might be different trip purpose requirements, mm-hmm. meaning in one town, you might be able to take your local bus to the hair salon, but in the town over, you might only be able to take it to medical appointments. There might be different hours of service. There might be different costs. And what this results in is just a really confusing system for people with disabilities. And it's not really anyone's fault. Mm-hmm. That's just how it's all played out over the course of the decades.
And give us an idea of what these services look like. You mentioned that there could be buses, there could be vans, but practically speaking here, what are we talking about?
It's as different in every community as you can imagine. In some communities, it might just be a van. It could be a 14-person van. It could be a minivan. It could be a PACE bus, a bus that PACE provides that's run locally by local operators. Mm-hmm. Or even in some cases, it's as simple as volunteers driving personal cars. So it really runs the gamut, and it depends on where you live, depends on the resources of the community that you're in.
And so with these different services, it's very difficult, at least it has been up until this point, where no one is really on the same page with trying to coordinate what they're doing from community to community.
Yeah, there are some efforts in the region to coordinate between some of these services. A lot of the counties have done a good job of trying to get the ball rolling there. There's a service called MC Ride in McHenry County, Ride DuPage, Ride in Kane, Will Ride. These are all efforts that the counties are making to bring some of these disparate services into the fold. And they've done a really great job, but there's a lot of progress that we can still do. Even in the services that are coordinated, they're really only coordinated on paper, because there are still individual services run by individual, what they call sponsors, at a township level or at a municipal level, who are able to set their own rules in terms of eligibility.
Well, let's talk about what can be done. You have a new report out right now called Toward Universal Mobility, and in it, the Metropolitan Planning Council makes some recommendations that will help improve transportation accessibility for everyone. So
that's right.
I know there's a bunch of stuff in this report, but briefly, maybe tell us maybe the top one or two. Like, what is something immediate that we can do here to get transportation more accessible to everybody?
Yeah, the report's number one recommendation is to establish a regional mobility coordinator. So that could be a person, it could be a group of people, and it would be a role that would take a more holistic look, kind of a 30,000 foot view of all of these services throughout the region, and not just these kind of secondary paratransit services, these services that most people aren't even aware of, but also looking at how they interact with the fixed route system. So our buses, our trains, our commuter rail system, and facilitate more collaboration between different units of government, identify gaps and needs in service throughout the region, better align the systems that already exist, and identify areas where there might be room for consolidation or service sharing or some sort of way to create more efficiency to improve the experience for the people that are using these services.
And how do we get something like this done? Because I know here in Illinois, we're always talking about finances and, oh, do we need to create a position? How are we going to pay for that? How are we going to muster the resources together to organize all of this? So is there, do you think, a collective political will to get something like this done?
I think so. I think there is. And I think the report does a really good job at illustrating why this is something we should all care about. There are over 800,000 people in the greater Chicago region currently experiencing a disability. Our region is expected to age considerably in the next 50 years. And as you get older, the prevalence of disability grows. So it's a virtual certainty that every one of us living here will either experience a disability ourselves or be a caretaker for someone who is experiencing a disability. So that's one thing. The second thing is, we're already spending millions of dollars here on transportation every year. We really just need to think about spending a little bit of that in a smarter way. It's not necessarily that we need to grow the pool, even though, of course, more resources would help, but mm-hmm. It's thinking about how to spend the money a little smarter.
And that's what this report's all about. So really talking about some reforms, some recommendations that can be implemented when we are talking about making transportation accessible to everyone, because really, when you think about it, we should be doing that. But I know right. that there has been this sort of, as you say, secondary network of transportation services for those with disabilities. So it's important that we keep this issue at the forefront to really make this accessible for everybody. You can go to metroplanning.org for the Metropolitan Planning Council to check out the report toward universal mobility. Jeremy Glover is a transportation associate at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Jeremy, thank you so much for talking to us today. This is really important, and good luck with all of your future endeavors, and hopefully we can get on the reform train here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It's hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. The strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Back here once again in the lair, the apartment of Steve Krakow for another Secret History of Chicago Music. And Steve, this week you are profiling and we are hearing music from the band Ear Dance. Ear Dance. That's an interesting name for a band. Ear Dance. And would you consider these musicians to be sort of like a prog band, or how does this fall into the category of music? Because it's, I don't know, it's a little different.
It is. They're a unique band. I think what's cool about them is that you wouldn't know exactly where to file them. But what I think is interesting, whereas a lot of progressive rock, you get rock guys trying to sort of play classical. These were classical musicians trying to play rock.
Interesting.
So I think this is what happens when you have some people who are so skilled technically, compositionally, and idea-wise, you get this crazy music that you just cannot really put your finger on.
It's definitely unique.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. And tell us about how Ear Dance comes about, because we're looking at the 1980s, right?
Yeah. It's an unconventional beginning for a band. I mean, they basically, more or less, the main guy, Jim Jacobson, met everyone at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, which is in Milwaukee. I did not know this. Or he grew up in Oshkosh. He met a few people there. So all these classically trained people he sort of met there. Then he went to grad school at U of C and decided, he saw King Crimson on TV. 1982 or 81 era, Discipline era for
yep.
those out there. Tony Levin on the Chapman stick bass.
Nice.
Which is a crazy instrument, and I have seen him play it live, I'm happy to say, 3 times. And he's all over that thing. That's all we can say. and Adrian Belew was in the band at that point, and I don't think he realized how much rock had sort of evolved. And here was this thing on TV. It was that show Fridays. Mm-hmm. That was sort of like a Saturday Night Live-ish thing. And I don't think he had realized, wow, look how far. This is some crazy avant-garde classically sort of tinged music that is on TV. He's like, I could do. So he kind of devised to start a studio only project, not a band to play live. Usually it's again the other way around.
Right.
You're jamming and then you're like, hey, let's record this. You know, he's like, no, I want to do this thing. He got in a studio. He sold shares of a record.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. So what was it like, publicly owned?
Basically, he got people sort of to invest in it, and you sort of had shares in this, and then he pressed 5,000 of those suckers. And I talked to him, and he was really nice and a very self-appreciating guy. He actually ended up being very successful in the music / film biz, but he was just like, we had no idea what we were doing. We were so naive. We were like, yeah, we'll make 5,000 copies of this record. We kind of have a distributor. They don't have any way of publicizing it. They don't have any way of anything. They were just like, let's do this, you know? And would half of the great artworks of the world be created without that sort of enthusiastic naivete? Probably not.
That's true. So, all right, Ear Dance coming around in like 1982, sort of like the reverse of how bands are formed. Classically trained musicians that try to do rock and roll. And the result of that, I mean, again, it is like you're not quite sure what to call this. You can kind of feel the rock tinge a little bit, but there's other stuff going on, other influences at work here. But that's what they wanted to do.
It's called Seek Opposites, and I feel like they were seeking the opposite of what a lot of bands wanted. But you know, they wanted success. They got a little airplay. You know, of course, he wanted it to be a successful project. It didn't make money, and he was bummed about it. He actually said the whole thing was pretty traumatic for him. I think the term he used, an ocean of sadness.
Oh, geez.
I know. I was like, whoa, that's intense. I guess one guy died young, and two people have passed away in the band. There's a cool lady in the band, and she is still making experimental music, Dixie Treichel, and he's known her since childhood. She's in Minneapolis. And Homero, who I spoke to as well, the drummer, he's like the chief percussionist in the Tucson Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, cool.
So he's doing all right, and his drumming on the album is insane. I mean, it does, as soon as I heard it, this was just a record I heard at the record store down the street. It was in the, like, Good Picks box, and I was like, oh, I think I've heard of this. This is local. Put it on, was like, oh my god, this sounds like 80s King Crimson. I could hear it right away in the guitar, though, like, wee, frip guitar, and then it was sort of polyrhythmic, and maybe at times the vocals, a little bit of David Byrne in there.
Yeah,
a little bit,
for sure.
And I guess that is something that was an influence, and they were also sort of accused of at the time. And I was just like, whoa, I just can't think of any band that sounded like this from Chicago, you know, offhand. And, you know, so this was kind of my favorite kind of secret music. Here's a mysterious record found in the store. What's the story? And I tracked down Homero because he, you know, he's percussionist of the symphony orchestra, so he was easy to find. He put me in touch with Jim, and then we had a really great conversation. And there was a later incarnation. So Homero moved right away to Tucson, actually. So that's why they were never a real band, is because he was flying in to record his parts. But there was a live version later on. It was him, the singer, and a guitarist, and they played it like Medusa's.
Really?
Yeah, and they played the Cubby Bear. which is crazy.
Right.
And I guess really pissed off audiences because they had like a drum machine and that wasn't really cool then with like a rock audience. But he said they had insane subwoofers that were like so strong they would sometimes knock the drum machine out of sync and they'd have to like reset it because it was so crazy. So I think they might have been kind of like fearsome live. And then that band moved out to LA, and just as Jim, the lead guy of the band, said, he said it just LA ate them up.
LA can do.
Within 8 weeks, 8 months, I can't remember what he said, it was just like they couldn't get the deal they wanted. But he stayed out there and ended up working in like film music. I guess he had a 20 minute almost piece of music used in Pulp Fiction.
That's cool.
That he did, and he basically bought a house off that. So he did okay, and he had music. He was embarrassed to tell me this. He was like, Steve, I don't know if I want to tell you this, but I had music on Baywatch.
Hey, man, look, if it pays the rent.
Exactly. You know, if it puts food on the table. It. I'm all for it. So, yeah, he's a super cool guy, and he's just been out in L.A. ever since and seemingly flourishing out there. And I think still making his own cool music.
Well, that's the story of Ear Dance. Woo. From around here. I mean, originally from Wisconsin, but down here in Chicago, they played out a lot. And I wouldn't be surprised here in this museum apartment of yours, Steve, if you had some VHS tapes of Baywatch.
That might be pushing it. I'm afraid I have some tacky stuff, I will admit it, but I do not think I have any Baywatch on VHS. Similar era, probably I do have something.
we've talked about it. Your apartment has a lot of stuff in it.
That is where I draw the line.
But you are an artist. You are a man of principle. The band that you are profiling this week in the Chicago Reader is Ear Dance. So pick up a free copy of the Chicago Reader all over Chicagoland. And go to chicagoreader.com to check out the secret history of Chicago music. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip that he hand draws and researches. He's also an artist and a local musician, music historian. Steve, thank you so much. And let's go watch an episode of Baywatch sometime.
Don't forget, David Hasselhoff is from the Chicago area.
Yes, the rap party for Outside the Loop, show number 686, where we just kind of recap the show.
686.
And that means 686, Colin. 4 years of high school Spanish.
Actually, it just means 686.
Right.
86 would be 86.
Oh, yeah.
You apparently didn't do so well in that high school Spanish class.
20 years ago was the last time I took a Spanish class. But, you know. Trying to keep it relevant here. I appreciate that, Colin.
Si se puede,
and I'll tell you, we covered a lot of issues on this week's show, I think.
Yeah, we got into it. I think the piece on Hampton and the transportation equally, like, really dense conversations that need to be had. Personally, the transportation angle, it's just something as simple as there is a lot of money that goes to transportation, but we can be smarter about how we apply it. I mean, and something really poignant is that a lot of these transportation options do not match up with a traditional full-time working schedule.
Right.
And just something as simple as that can really go a long way if you just think about that. Like, when do individuals, in this case, individuals with disabilities, when do they need to be transported? Well, if they're trying to get a job like everybody else, like this world that we're living in where go get a job, this is the structure of things, then you got to service that morning commute and you're not doing it.
And, you know, I think back to when we talked to Pia Justison, who wrote a book, sort of an oral history about living with disabilities. One of the things that she said was that the disability community is really the largest minority population in the world when you think about it. And over 1 billion people worldwide classify into that category. And so, yeah, I mean, we have to make this accessible to all. And I think we have a tendency in our society, and this is nothing new or this is not a big revelation, but what we do with people who are older and who are disabled, we tend to sort of like sweep them under the rug because maybe we don't want to deal with it. It's uncomfortable, but they are people, right? They are still people with needs just like everyone else. So I thought that what the Metropolitan Planning Council is trying to do, it's important. We should think about it. We should devote some resources to this to make this happen. And the other thing we mentioned, Colin, you talked about it briefly with the Fred Hampton story. I mean, just from a historical point of view, 50 years ago, this week, that happened, that event happened, that police raid on the flat where Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and other people were. And that's something that, you know, I think, again, we talk about civil rights, we talk about history, the Panthers, and we've talked about Panthers and the Black Panthers before on this program. They're definitely part of that conversation, but they might not get the top billing, as it were. We tend to think about the, you know, I think Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and then maybe the Black Panthers come in later. And not to take away from King or Malcolm X, but it was certainly a part of the historical conversation and part of the conversation about civil rights and the legacy of that today with Black Lives Matter and so on.
When I was just hearing the tape play back and the conversation you were having, I just would have really loved to have seen that man develop and see like what, like this notion of a Black Messiah. I just thought, like, what a really awful loss of life.
Yeah, it really was. And
like the potential that was lost there. That sucks.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if you go back and you watch his speeches, it's incredible. I mean, he could give a speech, and he was definitely passionate. From Maywood, Proviso East, went to Proviso East. And I believe there's the pool, the YMCA pool over there is named after Fred Hampton. So there you go. So we covered a lot of ground, Colin, and we learned that tacos are going to be paired with beer, which again is nothing revolutionary, but you know, you can go get your Half Acre and go get your Big Star. I mean, delicious. This is how we do it here in America, right?
Delicious nonetheless. Yes, it's work converging. Everything's converging, Mike.
Colin, I appreciate you.
Have a good one, everybody. See you next week.
That's the wrap party for Outside the Loop 686.
Wrap party.
And that just about does it for Outside the Loop show number 686. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.